G'day, welcome to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 320th. My name's Dick Newman. This will be Bonnie, Prince Charlie. Let's get on with it. Yeah, another one of the Bach boys there, Carl Bach, with his flute concerto. And we're going to get right back into the action straight after Culloden. Charles, having galloped off, is having a hard time believing the Highlanders had been defeated. As it sinks in, he will decide that his go at the big chair is, well, over. He's lost. There will be no attempt to rally the troops. He is galloping like crazy towards the west coast, hoping for a water Uber. The Highlanders now realise that they will be at the mercy of Willie, Duke of Cumberland, who has just earned the name Butcher. They will start to wish that Charles had gone down in a blaze of glory at Culloden, so to ensure his own reputation and perhaps appease the German royals. As for Charles, he'll get his own song for school children to sing so that they can hate him through the years. George and Ludham will get the news, so bonfires, bells, you know the drill by now. The official history has it that Willie was more than happy to pardon some rebels who surrendered after the battle. But just a few Highlanders did a Mel Gibson saying freedom all the time, so they got done. As for cruelty, well, it wasn't the guy who got the name Butcher out of this. That was actually Henry Hawley. He's the one who ordered the bayoneting of the wounded Jacobites and the hung, drawn and quartering of those who were well enough for a torture death. The English and the Dutchy troops will be nicely old-fashioned enough to wander around with the looting, raping and destroying of the Scotty Highlands. There will be a campaign against the Highlanders. Wade had built the roads and bridges after the Jacobite thingy in 1715, and now 31 years later they can be used for our troops to wander around being total assholes to the Highlanders. George is in no mood for mercy, and also Willie has not gone there to please them. His Majesty's second son and his officers were doing no more than carrying out government policy in Scotland, namely, starve the whole country, put a price on the heads of the chiefs, and let the Duke put all to fire and sword. Somewhere in all this came the rumour that the Scotties had been very nasty after the Battle of Prestonpans, but there's no evidence for that. It really does seem that Charles was a gracious winner. James, who almost got to be James III, was, of course, unhappy. He's been unhappy since the retreat of Derby, which he saw as the end of Frenchy support. Brother Henry was still hanging out at Dunkirk, and James will wisely write to him saying, whatever you do, don't blame the Frenchies for not launching the invasion. Hopefully Louis will make it a point of honour to be kind to your brother and you, whatever may happen. Brother Henry, though, can see it's all over, so we'll go to Paris to ask Louis to give him a military job. Sure, kiddo, go besiege Antwerp with the Comte de Clermont, and off he goes. But he will be on and on to the Frenchies to send a water Uber to Scotland for Charles. James will write to Charles with a fair amount of hope that his letters can be delivered. God knows where or when this may find you, my dearest Carluccio. But still I cannot but write to you in the great anxiety and pain I am in for you. I am, though, still in hopes you may be able to keep your ground in Scotland till you can have assistance from France. But if you really cannot maintain yourself in Scotland, do not, for God's sake, drive things too far, but think of your own safety, on which so much depends. Though your enterprise should miscarry, the honour you have gained by it will stick by you. It will make you respected and considered. Lovely letter, just what Charles wants to hear. As for Charles, it will be 5 months on the run and glory. This is the time that will score him the Skyboat song, annoying children for a long time. In that song, just like King Arthur and baby Jesus, Charles will come again to lead us into a golden age. But I'm tracking from Charles's finest hour, with narrow escapes, incredible risks, hardship, hasty disguises, hairsbreadth escapes, extraordinary adventures. We see true Scotty loyalty, daring and optimism that shall become legendary. £30,000 on his head, and he is not betrayed. This is testimony to Scotty loyalty and Charlie's heroism. And what a lot of crap, really. Yeah. Charlie was no braver than the Highlanders who had fought and died for him and are now hiding him. He expects their help and protection, which puts them in total danger. He seems to have his decision-making bits paralysed, letting other people come up and make all the decisions. He's got no plan and no intent to come up with a plan. Meanwhile, Willie the Butcher's men are in their burning homes, and I am not just talking about hovels. Hovels, sure, but also mansions, farms, crofts, whatever. Men, women and children are being bayoneted or hung or sent to the colonies or copping the full torture death. But for Charles, it's all, I've been let down by the Scotty chieftains. Charles remains selfish, conceited and naive. Still, these 5 months will toughen him up a bit. He will get to the West Coast to find zero Frenchy ships there to rescue him. We'll be off to the islands then to wait for that water Uber. Typically of a steward, he can sail straight into a storm and land on Benbecula in the Outer Hebrides. Soon as he left, two Frenchy ships turned up. Yeah, and nobody knows where he is. At least some Jacobites will be rescued and taken off to France. He will be island hopping to stay ahead of the authorities, who surely are out and about looking for him. This bit then will be physically tough going. There'll be shelter in caves or primitive huts and plenty of scratches from briars and bites from flies, so he'll have sores. The food is terrible. Aww. At least by now he is over his bad mood and his companions will be surprised by his cheerfulness. It might be something to do with there being plenty of booze for some reason. Don't know why, but there is plenty of booze. Charles will cop a break, being able to spend 3 weeks in a forester's hut on the island of South Whist. It will be nice weather, so there can be fishing and hunting and watching British warships wandering around. Troops will land, and Charles will be able to hang out for another couple of weeks, but it's getting a bit too hot there, and he'll need to move on. The island of Skye is obvious, but he can't walk there. There's a woman. Oh, thank God, my dear listener. Thank God. An intelligent human. Unless she's one of those newfangled women with a penis. No penis, great. Meet Flora MacDonald, who is staying with a brother at the moment, but her mum lives on Skye. Flora is 24 and a bit like Clementina, I reckon. She isn't a great beauty, but she's got lovely eyes, and like Clementina, her largest nose seems to work for her. I don't know what it is for these girls and their largish noses that seem just a little bit sexy. I don't know. There we go. Also, like Clementina, Flora is calm, sensible and forthright. She'd been homeschooled but was intelligent. Why did I say but? She'd been homeschooled and was intelligent. That's better. Flora's dad had died and her mum had remarried a guy who lived on Skye. Flora spent her time at both homes, so certainly knew how to move back and forth between the two islands. It was one of Charles's companions, Captain O'Neill, who had met Flora and been impressed, so it is he who has come up with the cunning plan. Charles to get full-on drag and then enter Miss Holland. No, he's not going to enter Miss Holland. He's going to go full drag and then go as Flora's maid to her Skye house, or Skye Island. Flora's stepdad was the commander of the militia on Skye, so he can issue the necessary pass. Marvellous. O'Neill will sneak on into Flora's bedroom. Never a good idea, gentlemen listeners. Do not break and enter ladies' bedrooms or examine her phone for that matter. O'Neill, though, can outline the cunning plan, and Flora says, oh, no way, it's too dangerous, dickhead. It endangers lots of people. And then even if we succeed, everyone will think that Charles has had his wicked way with me, and my reputation will be in tatters. Yeah, nah, says O'Neill, Charles isn't into bagging cheeky babes, and hey, you could go down in history. Just think, your name mentioned in future podcasts. It'll still be a no way from Flora, so we'll have to bring Charles in to do the charming, and charming he will be, so it'll be okay, but fuck knows where I'll find a frock big enough for you, so keep on hiding until I do. That will take another week, because we're going to have to make one. But Flora has written to Mum saying she will be bringing Betty Burke, an Irish girl who, as a good spinster, would be able to help her with her spinning. Stepdad will issue the passes. Lady Clarence Ranald, who has been brought into the plan, has her ladies making a frock for a six-footer, and it'll take all week, but they'll do it. Finally, we're done, and Flora has a six-foot frock, along with three passes. Charles herself, and we're also taking McKeegan, who will pretend to be Flora's servant. Charles will say, O'Neill must come, but Flora will say, no, I've got three passes, so three people only. Charles will say, okay. Charles will say, okay, well, just wait on them while I stick a pistol up my skirt. Flora will say, no again. If they put their hands up your frock, then the pistol will be a dead giveaway. Charles will point out that if they put their hand up his frock, then there's something else there that will be a dead giveaway. But Flora ain't taking no shit. The pistol will stay behind. Okay, soon as it's dark, we can get underway with Charles in his frock, a white apron, a frilly hat, and a hooded coat. All we have to do is avoid the British ships on a wet and stormy night. There are five boatmen who all know the true identity of Betty Burke, but not too sure where Sky is. Oh, fuck. Charles will be cheerful singing old Jacobite songs like Speed, Bonnie Bode, like a bird on a wing. No, you're not going to sing that one. Like the King shall enjoy his own again. But here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, in the middle of the Skyboat song, like a bird on the wing, carrying the lad that's born to be king over the sea to Sky. And of course we get Sky and straight into trouble. It's shots coming from the militia, so they need to sail further along to find a safe spot to land. Flora will be off to Lady Margaret MacDonald for help, telling the boatmen that if the soldiers turn up, they are to curse Charles as lazy for not having followed his mistress to Lady MacDonald's home. Just as well that Charles got left behind, because Lieutenant MacDonald of the militia was at MacDonald House looking for Charles. MacDonald has four guys with him, and plenty more are out and about on Sky looking for the prince. Flora is cool, calm, and collected, but Lady MacDonald is not. She'll be boo-hoo-hooing to her guy. Oh, he's yet another MacDonald. That she will be ruined. Okay, says this MacDonald guy. I'll get the prince out of here to Rase Island. Step one for this MacDonald will be to collect Charles and take him home. Off he goes, and he'll find Charles. Flora will catch up with him. Here we go, and the daughter of the house will say, Oh, mother, my father has brought in a very odd, muckle, ill-shaken up wife as ever I saw. I never saw the like of her. Mother can only agree. I saw such an odd, muckle trollop of a carlin making a lane-wide step through the hall that I could not like her appearance at all. Oh, God. I don't know if I'm doing well with the Scotty, but then this muckle, whatever, will kiss a hand and, oh, the muckle has whiskers. The prince, oh lord, we're a ruined and undone forever. We'll be a hanged now. She'll get over it and serve up some eggs and cheese. And then booze. Yeah, more booze. And then a bit more booze. So it'll be up late with a plan to get to Rase Island. Mrs. MacDonald will take a lock of Charlie's hair and wrap it up in the sheets she'd slept in so she could be buried in them eventually. Off he goes, first stop to Portree, where Flora is waiting. He will ditch the frock and get back into his Highland dress. Flora and McKeegan are waiting in a little inn, so it'll be a bottle of booze first. And have you got another bottle of that whiskey? Oh, great. Towards dawn, it'll be time to say goodbye to Flora. For all that has happened, I hope, madam, we shall meet at St. James's yet, and I will reward you there for what you have done. Oh, and here's the garters from my drag outfit as a goodbye gift. Off they go across the shimmering sea to Rase. Off goes Flora to a rest in the summer for about a year. No rewards will be coming from Charles. And that is the romantic story, except, yeah, there wasn't any romance there. Flora was simply a brave and smart woman who felt obliged to help out a royal. Charles just accepted her help as if it was due to him. Charles will be back to Skye at some point and then back to the mainland. He'll be wandering around mainly at night, trying to keep one step ahead of the authorities. Nobody will give him away, not even the Scottish chieftains who want nothing to do with him. Each refusal is a shock for Charles, but there's plenty of people who will help him. He's wandering through desolate country, houses burned, crops ruined, cattle chased off, all because of him. Fuck him. Sometimes people manage to get Charles off just before being arrested themselves. Food is problematic for him and his appearance will change. He's dishevelled, wearing dirty, filthy, torn clothes, an old black cloak, and he's barefoot by now. He's got long hair and a beard and lice. He's got a musket, a pistol and a dagger. He's also in very good spirits. It's still just a game with all mail company, booze as often as he can get it, telling stories of adventures and escapes. Just marvellous good fun. Eventually, though, word will come out that a couple of Frenchy privateers have sailed in. Charles will set out immediately, and on the 19th of September, he will be aboard La Heroux. It had been over a year since he first landed at Scotland at the same place he's leaving. Had talked the reluctant chiefs into his rebellion, and now he's leaving behind a country to which he's brought a lot of suffering. But in spite of that, he's gained a reputation for bravery, happiness, and chivalry. Wanker. Yeah, enough of that romantic clap-clap. The guy was a turd. This had been a terrible time for the Highlanders. It does seem that a fair few former Jacobites did accept jobs in the government army. That had been on the basis that Willie Duke of Cumberland offered them a pardon if they gave themselves up. But there were pockets of Highlanders who wanted to resist. Oh, dear me. And the Duke of Cumberland found that pretty bloody annoying. And so it seems that we are to put the blame mainly on Henry Hawley, who some claim was an illegitimate kiddie of German George. Historians, though, can't see how he could have been, really. Let's not speculate on his parents, but say that to his own troops, he was known as Hangman Hawley, and was apparently very nasty to his own guys. So the enemy can't expect much sweetness from him. We get different numbers, but there's certainly grand unhappiness with things like 650 prisoners dying awaiting trial. 650! How can you manage to lose that many? As for what was happening in the Highlands, well, Reign of Terror comes to mind. At least the government won't be doing a lot of confiscating lands. They tried that out last time and found out that Highlands land was worth so little they couldn't recover their costs of confiscation and selling. Some Scotty nobles will have their heads off, but by the time that happened, public opinion had changed from fear of the Scotties to sympathy. Yeah, sympathy suddenly. And the royal pardons can commence. Flora MacDonald, who had got Charles over to Skye, refused to go into hiding and so was arrested. Once in London, Prince Fred will visit her, and he was so impressed he got her a pardon. His missus, the Princess Augusta, will be annoyed and criticise Flora. Fred will say that if he'd been in Charles's shoes, then he hoped his dear missus would have acted as Flora had done. Fred will go on to oppose harsh anti-Highlands legislation, irritating the royal family. Princess Amalia had some sympathy, not a lot, but some, for 80-year-old Simon Fraser, Lord Lovett. This is the father of Simon Lovett, who had started marching towards Culloden when he saw the Jacobites running away and so went home. Anyway, young Simon was right as rain, but old Simon was nabbed, put on trial and found guilty. The hang, drawn and quartering was commuted to beheading by George, but really, you're going to say, why would you kill an 80-year-old? Oh well, they wanted to. 9th of April, 1747. And off we go to Tower Hill. And it's a really, really big crowd. They want to see this guy done. A timber stand had been built for your viewing pleasure. But so many people got on the thing, it collapsed. That will give Lord Lovett a good laugh, which some people suggest led to the saying to laugh your head off. Off comes Lovett's head, and that is the last beheading in England. Of a live guy, anyway. Lovett lives on in the fictional Highlander, I believe. Anyway, Princess Amalia was with me on the why kill an 80-year-old thingy, and will say of those injured in the timber stand collapse that they'd suffered fairly for their nonsensical curiosity. Some lords will be pardoned, some won't. Guys like Murray will die in exile. One guy, Archie Cameron, snuck back into Scotland for a visit and was betrayed by his own guys. His head will be off in 1753, and having just said that Lovett was the last beheading, I've gone straight into Archie Cameron having his head off, so let's clarify. Archie Cameron was hung for 20 minutes, so he should have been well and truly dead. Then he'll be taken down and then beheaded. How fucking stupid, isn't it? He will be the last Jacobite to be executed. He was known as the gentle physician and left a pregnant missus and 8 kiddies behind. That's terrible, isn't it? At Preston Pans, he treated a wounded Hanoverian officer and was an advocate of no executions for any prisoners. The road system in the Highlands, kicked off by Wade, will be increased and mapping made so we can find our way around the bloody place. New forts will be built. The government also wants to weaken the already weakened clan system. This is kind of like the feudal system. Well, it is really a feudal system. We'll be having the Heritable Jurisdictions Scotland Act of 1746, and that will pretty much kill that feudal system. There had been a position called Sheriff Principal operating for about 500 years. That position was hereditary, but this act will return the power to appoint sheriffs to the Crown. That will greatly reduce the power of the chiefs over the common smellies. The government will have a go at banning tartan, but even governments can sometimes figure out bans don't work. Turning people into criminals for wearing particular clothing is pretty stupid. That act will be repealed, but it's going to take them 36 years to work it out. We saw that Jacobite turnout in England didn't happen. With a slate of Stuart turning up, we're even more disillusioned. Jacobites in England are in total decline. Lots of Scots are also now disillusioned. They've seen Charles in action. The Irish Jacobite movement will continue for a bit, but they'll soon work out that they're actually anti-English, not really pro-Stuart. So the Jacobites in Ireland will be absorbed by the Society of United Irishmen. The Frenchies will commission a report that is highly critical of the Stuarts and recommend that the Frenchies no longer support the Stuart cause. If we want to create a wedge with England, then we should support a Scotty Republic. Well, that'd be a good idea. Charles's brother Henry is about to become a 22-year-old cardinal. Celibacy for him. Well, not initially. Harry was made a Cardinal 8, which is a widow invention of the church for guys who want to be a cardinal and married. So long as they don't get ordained as a priest as well, they can be a cardinal and keep on banging. Henry will say, nah, I'm up for the whole lot, so ordain away. Yeah, make me a priest. He will have a big churchy career, which will not make Charles happy at all. Charles will end up getting booted out of France, and he can become an alcoholic. James will die in 1766, but Big Papa Pope Clement XIII will not be calling Charles Charles III. No, that title will have to wait for our own times and our current glorious big chair warmer. Charles will die bitter and twisted as an old man of 68. The only kind of good news to come out of this is the Highlanders will no longer be considered wild men barbarians of the north and terribly scary eaters of babies. No, they will now be noble warriors fighting for Britain and freedom and democracy and all good stuff, wearing their tartans and be very scary, but not to us anymore. Yeah, something like that. Now, is there anything else I want to tell you about Charlie before we piss him off forever? I guess I should let you know he did meet up with Clementina Walkinshaw again. And this time he will work out that his part P gets inserted into her slot B. And if you move it around, then you end up with a Charlotte Stuart Duchess of Albany. Clementina will live to 82. Charles will marry a Lowlander girl from modern-day Belgium. Princess Louise of Stolberg-Gedden. She'll be smart enough to give him the flick pretty smartly. She's worked out he's a dickhead. But they will have 0 kiddies. If I So let us say that the rebellion of 45 is over, but we still seem to be at war. George is dead keen that the war keep going and will approve a raid on the Frenchy coast. The French is doing well on land while the British are doing well at sea. Lord Anson will rout a Frenchy fleet at the Cape Finisterre in May 1747, Finisterre being off the west coast of Spain, with Finisterre meaning the end of the earth. The Romans thought that was it, no more land after that. Prince Fred will issue a manifesto promising to abolish all distinctions for party. What? For parties? What is this little shit up to, wonders George. Me too, George. Oh, I know, says George. I will call a general election to minimise whatever naughtiness is coming in from that prince. Whigs will score 338, up 52. Tories 117, down 19. Opposition Whigs 94, down 37. The Tories are becoming an irrelevant bunch of country gentlemen. The real power struggle still lies within the Whig Party. But this was a pretty good result for their leader, Henry Pelham. Not a good result for our Prince of Wales, who campaigned against the government. He thought he could get the votes of disaffected Jacobites to go against the Whigs, but it would seem not. He was saying that Pelham was stuffing up the war and that his dad, George, needed to be redeemed from the grubby hands of the ministers. The naval war is going bad for Spain and France, who are both under pressure to make peace. George will be off to Hanover with Newcastle. A decent settlement will be reached in autumn, but that is without Maria Theresa, who is still waiting for Silesia to be returned. It is the Frenchies and English who will draft up the peace treaty. English, Frenchy and Spanish lands all to be returned to what they were before the Biff. Oh, there you go. So what was the point of it all? That is, European lands, so far as colonial stuff goes, well, we'll all just keep on grabbing as much as we can. The duchies will get no say because they fail to cover themselves in military glory. William of Orange has been shafted, and Anne can only try to comfort him by calling her brother Willie, the Duke of Cumberland, the Fat Generalissimo. She's finally become a bit of a duchy, and will also be against her dad George, oh dear, and call England the great enemy, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Yes, another international marriage of a princess to cement relationships between two countries has gone wrong. The War of Austrian Succession is over, and George can see they need to stay close to the Empire in the face of growing Frenchy aggression. There's also that growing threat from Prussia towards England and Hanover. The biggest deal, though, at the moment is colonial possessions. There is a general consensus around that position, but it is William Pitt who has spotted the big hairy deal in the future will be the Navy and the control of the Americas. Pitt's time has not yet come. It will. Really, though, I should let you know some stuff about Maria Theresa, our holy sausage empress. That poor girl will be knocking out a heap of kiddies. 16 little buggers. Dukes, duchesses, archduchesses, an emperor. Youngest kiddie will be an archbishop, and two of them will be queens. So it will be the second youngest kitty who will be the Queen of France, Maria Antonia, known as Marie Antoinette. Yeah, she will end up marrying Louis XVI as part of a peace deal. George is 64 and has agues, that's probably malaria, agues, and he's also got piles, and we all think he won't be around much longer. Prince Fred can't wait, so we'll create a shadow cabinet which meets regularly at Carlton House to formulate policy, ready for the takeover. Plans are made for the detachment of Hanover. Plans are made to raise a large militia, which they think is way better than a standing army. Standing armies cost heaps, whereas a militia doesn't. There will be lots of fine words about free and fair elections with no corruption and abuses of officers. Yeah, very fine words to help balance our discussions into shitfuckery to make sure these guys win a majority government. The last thing they really want is a free and fair election. Pelham is getting a bit concerned about the perceived strength of the Prince's party. The Prince has been promising lots of jobs for the boys, so he's gathering in strength. What really seems to be going on is that Freddie's worried that George will pull a Swifty and try to get the Duke of Cumberland in as the next king. There's no evidence for that at all, and we call paranoia fed by supporters on Prince Fred. It still isn't going well between Dad and Lad. Duke of Somerset will lead the chancellorship of Cambridge Uni. Oh, there's a job that's open. Fred will allow his name to be put up, but then George will veto it. George will write to the uni saying he has no intent of interfering with their free and fair election before vetoing Fred, thus interfering with their free and fair election. Newcastle will score the gig. 1751, and it's a pamphlet. Constitutional queries earnestly recommended to the serious consideration of every true Briton. It compares Willie, Duke of Cumberland, to Richard III, in that Willie would not hesitate to take control of the army to usurp the big chair. The government will order copies to be tracked down and destroyed with an investigation into naming that author. Oh yes, it's anonymous once again. It's suspected that it comes from Prince Fred's mob, but the subject of Willie's rather large military power will be discussed. He's got some. But gosh darn it, Prince Fred's unwell. He'd been working in the garden when it poured with rain, so became a soggy prince. Soggy prince got a runny nose. Runny nose turned into pleurisy. Just as well we have German doctors with the latest in medical science to join in with the obligatory bleeding. Prince Fred will be bled to make him a bit weaker. That's the new-fangled blistering from Germany. This medical blistering required applications of a fine powder, usually composed of canthrides, a powerful blistering substance, often obtained from blister beetles, and it's sometimes called Spanish fly. Sometimes other stimulant ingredients, such as pepper, mustard seed, and verdigris, were added. The fine powder and stimulants were then mixed with plasters or other compositions of the same consistency and spread on the skin surface to produce a blister. The concoction was left on the skin from a few hours to many hours, depending on the extent of medical blistering required. Good luck with that, Fred. 31st of March, 1751, age 44, Prince Fred will yell out, "Je sens la mort." I'm not sure why he went all Frenchy on us, but what he's saying is, "I feel death." Hey, yes, dead right. So, yeah, dead and right. Right and dead. He's dead. His death was so sudden, we'll have an autopsy. Maybe not a good one. The cause of death is given as an abscess in his breast that broke and suffocated him. This could have been from a cricket ball or a thing called a real tennis ball. Both a cricket ball and a real tennis ball have cork as their core and will certainly cause you a lot of pain if you're hit. Modern types, huh? Think that Fred died of pneumonia. Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case loving you. No pills gonna kill my head. I got a bad case loving you. Yes, a sad day for cricket too, with Prince Fred dying, because he certainly was a supporter of the sport. He had his own team here and there and really promoted it, got it going. But he's dead now. Also sad for cricket is, of course, Imran Khan is in the slammer. Well, this guy is just a little bit older than me. Pakistani guy, if you've never heard of him. He was what they call an all-rounder. He could bat and bowl. Marvellous cricketer. And one of those guys who not only got to be able to play for his country, he became like an international star. So he's one of those that's really well remembered. Eventually, of course, he got too old to play cricket, so he gave it up and kind of retired, thinking, what will I do? What will I do? Should I do good things? He said, yeah, I probably should do good things. So he did stuff like build schools and hospitals. He went around internationally raising extra money to put in with his own money to do these lovely projects. And found that quite satisfying. building things like schools and hospitals. But he realised that, really, if he wanted to make a big effect in Pakistan, then he would have to get into politics. So he got into politics. And in his first election, the Imran Khan party got one seat, his own. But he managed to end up becoming the Prime Minister. But sadly, Imran is a peacenik, and the world doesn't seem to like peaceniks. You're either with us or against us, said George W. Bush. And Imran is not really with the US, so he was considered to be against them. He got arrested, and he claimed that the US were instrumental in his overthrow, which people said, yeah, poo-poo, no, nothing to see here. But, of course, documents have since come out that makes it certainly look like that is the case. Anyway, he's in the slammer. I doubt if he'll be coming out any time soon.
Lily's pounding down like a machine. Pascal's making divots in the green. Marsh is taking wickets. Hooks, he's clearing pickets. And the chapel's eyes have got that killer gleam.
Come on, Aussie, come on, come on. Come on, Aussie, come on.
Gossip magazines can have it as poison given to him by his missus, either because she was having an affair with John Stuart, Earl of Bute, his Lord of the Bedchamber, or because she was ambitious to become regent in the event of their eldest son succeeding the throne before he came of age. No evidence for anything like any of that at all. By this time, his Mrs. Augusta had knocked out 8 kiddies, with another one on its way. The youngest one will be Caroline Matilda, who will get to marry Danish King Christian VII, her first cousin and a crazy king. Yeah, it's crazy kings are back in fashion. So, welcome to the world, and perhaps not a happy life at all, Caroline Matilda. But the point is, Fred is dead, and what have we got to say for the lad? Here lies poor Fred, who was alive and is dead. Had it been his father, I had much rather. Had it been his sister, nobody would have missed her. Had it been his brother, still better than another. Had it been the whole generation, so much better for the nation. But since it is Fred, who was alive and is dead, there is no more to be said. So Fred was our first cricketing royal, I think I've covered that, cricketing. At the time, was actually the most popular sport in England under Fred. It was perhaps more the gambling than the game, but who cares? Fred studied it, then started playing, then started forming his own teams from time to time. But however did George take the news? You can take your pick from these. It was factual that he was playing cards at the time of Lady Yarmouth, the Baroness von Walmalden. Well, I still can't say that. I'm going to not say it. When a messenger brought the news. One version says he merely said, "Why, they told me he was better." Continued with his game and then, sometime later, remarked how glad he was. According to another, he was visibly upset. I like to believe the second one, that he was upset. He will visit his daughter-in-law and they will have a good boo-hoo-hoo together. George will call in his grandsons to tell them they need to be brave boys and obedient to their mum. 12-year-old grandson George will say nothing and nearly faint. He will put his hand on his heart and say, "I feel here as I did when I saw the workman fall from the scaffold of Kew." What? What's that got to do with anything, George? Fred will be buried without ceremony. No anthems, no organ banging out a tune, with just the Duke of Somerset as chief mourner. None of the family attended, and due to a cock-up, invites had been sent out last minute. Apart from the pallbearers and some guys with ceremonial functions, we had no English lords, no bishops, just one Irish lord, 2 sons of dukes and 2 privy councillors. This is the exact opposite of a big show, but I guess Fred didn't care being all dead and everything. Henry Pelham was pleased. Without the prince, the opposition should fall to bits. Prince Fred did not have a big reputation. He was seen as a lightweight. If he was popular at all, it was more about we didn't like George than we did like Fred. It was perhaps not the happiest of lives, with his mum and dad both not liking him. Nor did they trust him enough to give him some sort of a job. He was forced to try and find his own way while sitting around waiting for the big job. At the time of Fred's death, his brother, Willie, Duke of Cumberland, was not a popular duke at all. He has been reforming the army, wanting it to be more professional. That means a bit more discipline among the troops. The gentry are pissed off that Willie was looking to abolish the promotion by purchase idea in favour of promotion by merit. Yes, a bit strange. They were also annoyed that he had the power of the courts martial and thought he was treating our brave English boys like Hessian mercenaries. And of course our English still hate the idea of a standing army in peacetime. They said that someone might be able to get hold of that army and force regime change. The ministers didn't like him and the opposition didn't like him for being the favourite son. He had been popular a bit for winning at Culloden, but now tales of cruelty the Scotties are coming in. A lot of unhappiness, though, could be resentment about his Germanic-type desire for thoroughness and efficiency. We English are a bit more relaxed. There are plenty of people who think Willie will use the military authority to stage a coup d'etat against his nephew. King George will say, "Nah, that's all bullshit. There is nothing to justify such thinking." That's correct. Even so, the national mood makes it difficult to think of Willie as regent if something were to happen to George. George is by now 67, and only Super Ted and the Gloriana have lived longer than that. We're thinking that George hasn't got long to go. George will talk to Pelham and Newcastle, pointing out that Willie is the right person to be regent. Yeah, nah, they both say, nah. The general public would not accept young Prince George being placed in the care of his uncle. William Pitt is also warning that if the Princess of Wales were to suddenly die, then poor young George would be in the hands of his evil Uncle Willie. And we're still thinking of Richard III, and where are those missing princes in the Tower? We need a compromise. Princess to be the regent, assisted by a council of 12, with Willie being the president of the council. Princess to have limited powers and cannot change the members of the council on her own. Team Willie will be wanting to go to Parliament and thrash it out and get him in as regent, but Willie will say no. He will, of course, now be anti-Pelham and anti-Pitt. George seems to be kind and almost affectionate towards the Princess and the kiddies, except perhaps our new Prince of Wales, George. The new Prince of Wales is required to go and live with Grandad at Hampton Court. George will soon be grumbling that young George lacked the desire to please. He'll lose his temper with the boy and give him a belting. Princess Augusta, meantime, will continue to whinge that Willie is an intriguer against young George and the succession. There's still no evidence to support that view. On that basis, she'll hang out more with George and be nice to his ministers. That's the king she's hanging out with. Before you know it, she's complaining that King George is refusing to pay off Fred's debts. That's especially annoying to her because the king was saving about £30,000 a year from Fred's death. She'd be happy if he stopped being so nice, so long as he stopped putting her money in his pocket. Then it's back to complaining about Willie, and this time Princess Amelia. Yeah, Augusta now thinks Amelia is against her too. The only one of his kiddies that George likes is Willie. And the Princess of Orange is like George. She's pompous. She nags him so much that when he goes to Hanover, he avoids her. Amelia is prematurely deaf. She has knocked back a lot of German princes for husbands, instead having affairs with English nobles. She settled down to spinsterhood and likes horses, cards and gossip. She hangs out with Willie so much that when he's invited anywhere, people know to invite her as the plus one. Willie also hasn't married. George wanted to do a deal with Denmark, who had a deformed princess on the table. Willie wasn't keen, so asked Walpole for advice. "Hey, kiddo, say yes to the marriage on the condition that you and the deformed bride immediately score a nice big mansion full of all sorts of goodies. That way, the marriage will never happen. Yeah, dead right. Princess Carolyn is also a spinster and seen as pathetic. She's retired into seclusion following the death of Lord Harvey. It seems he was the only person she actually cared for. Hardly anyone sees her anymore. She's handing out money to charities, with all those who care for the welfare of prisoners doing very well. Princess Anne will from time to time look for husbands for Amelia and Carolyn and get rather sharp letters back. I sometimes believe you think that unmarried women have no place in heaven. You think nobody can have the least happiness without being tied from morning to night to a creature which may tire one's life out and plague one incessantly with their good advice or commands, while one is as full as wise as they, and the only difference of dress and fashion allowing them all lots of things which women must not do because it's not discreet. We poor women have great disadvantages without making them still worse and putting oneself in a jackanapes power. Ooh, that's a bit harsh on men. I guess, though, that these girls witnessed their mum's marriage to George and saw that marriage may not be that heavenly. The two youngest girls married and may have wished they stayed like their elder sisters as spinsters. Mary, who it was said was just sweetness and light, married the awful Landgrave Fred of Hesse Castle. She'll knock out four boys for him, then run away back to England for a bit. But then it will be back to Germany to give it another go. But they'll separate after 14 years together. Mary will want to stay in Germany to be with the boys, so her father-in-law will actually support her financially. Louisa, the youngest, will marry Prince Fred of Denmark and so will become Queen of Denmark. Like her mum, she will cop a strangulated hernia and die in childbirth after years of suffering. King Fred will do some boo-hoo-hooing when she dies and then hit the bottle, dying of liver cancer in 1766, aged 42. And just before Louisa died, Anne had become a widow, with the deformed Prince of Orange dying at 40. A post-mortem showed that his twisted backbone had gradually narrowed the gap between his collarbone and his breastbone, so his jugular vein was pressed, and eventually that started blocking the blood supply to his heart and lungs. Oh, dear, what did George have to say? This has been a fatal year for my family. I lost my eldest son, but I'm glad of it. The Prince of Orange died and left everything in confusion. Poor little Edward has been cut open. Now the Queen of Denmark is gone. I know I did not love my children when they were young. I hated to have them running in my room, but now I love them as well as most fathers. Poor little Edward was the Duke of York, Fred's second boy, who had an abscess cut out. He's a bit sickly and won't be with us too long. He will write a rather sweet letter to Anne, but Anne is not ready to forgive and forget the bad treatment she believes that she and William of Orange got from the English. She's assuming that George wants to run Holland through her. Anne is regent for 3-year-old. Let's see, what's his name? Oh, it's William. Yeah, who would have guessed that? Anne will be a rather good regent and worker, with the big problem she was arrogant and so much disliked. George will go to Hanover and once again avoid Holland. For all his sentimental writing, he does not want to see Anne. So not long after this, Mary will leave that bloody dipshit Fred Margrave whatever, with his conversion to the Catholic stuff being the last straw for Mary. So she was off with the boys to Hanover, where she can rebuild the Schloss Rumpenheim. It was said her health improved following her release from the tyrant.
Unchain my heart, baby, let me be. 'Cause you don't care, well, please set me free. Unchain my heart, baby, let me go. Unchain my heart, 'cause you don't love me no more.
So 1753 and George has hit 70. He'll complain that while he was once strong, he is now old and useless. And yeah, George, I know how you feel, mate. By now, we are all used to the old fart, so we have a grudging admiration for him. Not me, my dear listener, the people at the time. It still isn't going well for the Princess Augusta, who thinks Willie is up to no good. Young George will visit Willie, who has his walls decorated with military stuff. George will show interest in that stuff, so Willie will get a sword down and unsheath it. George will piss his pants, and Willie's horrified that George thought he was going to do him in or something. Willie will complain to Augusta that she's filling the boy's head with nonsense. I missed his sweet uncle. Augusta has been relying on the Earl of Bute, who is George's tutor, and may have been Augusta's lover, but yeah, I don't really think so. There will be a bit of a stoush going on in the prince's household, and King George will step in. It's allegations that some guys were trying to turn young George into a Jacobite, and that also seems pretty bullshitty, really. King George, like me, saw it that way, but a couple of guys will be sacked and replaced by the Earl of Waldegrave and the Bishop of Peterborough. That will annoy Parliament because the Earl's granny, the Earl of Waldegrave's granny, was an illegitimate daughter of James II, and the Bishop of Peterborough was a Tory, a bloody Tory. Oh, well. There will be much discussion in Parliament about these two guys, but at the end of the day, they will be in leading Princess Augusta to actually praise... Bloody dicky birds. They'll be leading Princess Augusta in to actually praise King George, and perhaps that would be the first time in her life, pretty much, that she's ever said anything nice about George. Earl Waldegrave will note that young George was bored, disliked book learning, but was not unintelligent, and in that last bit gave us a double negative, naughty Earl. You're supposed to be tutoring the kid. Don't tutor him into double negatives. That's naughty. King George will now be able to put his name to the formation of that marvellous British Museum. Yes, the old Britmus, as we said in my schoolboy days, is about to pop into existence. And they've had its start thanks to Sir Hans Sloane. This guy's parents migrated from Scotland to Ireland. Yeah, why would you do that? I don't know. He became a doctor to the rich and famous with patients like, well, Queen Anne, German George, and this George. He lived just up the street from where the Britmus is and was a keen collector of objects from around the world. His collection got so big he bought the house next door to keep it all. Right now, he is 92 years old and not long for the world, so he wants his collection to go to the public in a new museum. But wait, there's more. Joining Sir Hans is John Cotton, whose granddad, Sir Robert Cotton, created the Cotton Library in 1594. That's back in the time of the Gloriana. He will donate that collection to the Brit Mus. And joining those two will be the library of old Robert Harley, the Earl of Oxford, who collected quite extensively. Eventually, George will hand over the old Royal Library, which had been started way back, if you recall, by Baby Ted. Oh shit, long time ago that. 1754, and time for Pelham to be off to heaven. No worries, we got his brother Newcastle to step in as Chief Minister. Yeah, except Newcastle does like a bit of war, and things aren't going so well with the Frenchies. The Frenchies have their eye on colonial expansion in the Americas and that trade in India. England sees France as a threat, while France sees England as, oh, a threat. But neither want war. Yeah, not really. George, in particular, is concerned that a war with France would see the Frenchies attacking Hanover, then would need Austrian help, then the German princes would be lining up for cash, and oh dear, the English taxpayers would need to stump up cash to support a stupid foreign war. And so let's have a look at the duchies, and we will see once again that the duchies are over a lot of us, so they'll be neutral and no help at all. Newcastle is looking to protect English settlers in North America and Canada from Frenchies while doing nothing that would provoke war right here in England and France. What has been going on is that the Frenchies have established a series of forts along the rivers St. Lawrence, Ohio, and Mississippi. Hang on, have they been reading Alfred the Great for Dummies? Seems that way. These forts are for defence and training with the locals. The British colonials see these forts as offence, and so they want defence. Oh, dear me. Can you send troops, please, England? Now, I have to say that George was not always thick as a brick. He thinks sending troops trained in, say, the lowlands to Mississippi may not be a good idea. He wants to support a local colonial militia in the Americas, give them equipment, including bangy stuff, and send some really good officers and instructors to train them and make America great again with that very strong, well-trained militia. Willie, the Duke of Cumberland, will say, hang on, Daddy-O, our regular troops are first class, so send two regiments under the very sound command of Major General James Braddock. Well, what can you say to your favourite kiddie, my dear listener? What George should have said is, I'm right and you're wrong, Willie. That's what he should have said. Very sound Major General James Braddock will march his guys straight into a French and Indian ambush. Well, sort of. But our brave English boys will be shooting at, well, oh, look, let me do it properly. Sorry. Fortunately for the Americans, one of their volunteers, a guy called George Washington, was left behind on this field trip. Yeah, that was handy. He won't die. The idea was multiple attacks by the English and colonials on Frenchy forts. That's what we planned to do. So we sent off a few expeditions, and one of them was General James Braddock. Our guys and the Frenchies with their Indian allies nearly collided head on. The professional English troops did okay initially, but the Frenchies and the Indians knew the turf, so they went running up and down the English lines, firing into the flanks. We had Canadian militia with us, and they got the fuck out for some successful running away, but the British just didn't know what to do. The front attempted a withdrawal, but they ran straight back into their own guys, and it's confusion, and we can't shoot at anything, because we can't see those Frenchies and Indians there in the trees. Braddock will score a bullet to the chest, and he is done. The Americans had come in and managed to take a position in the tree line, so the British thought that they were the Frenchies, and now we're firing at the bloody Americans. There is an unverified story that it was an American that actually killed Braddock to stop his silliness. George Washington returned and managed to get some of our brave boys out. He's not to know he'll soon be trying to kill them. And just to finish off, I think I might toss in Hugh Mercer to the story. Hugh was a medical-type Jacobite who'd been an assistant surgeon for Bonnie Prince Charlie. He was a Culloden but managed to escape, and after some hair-raising adventures got himself all the way to America. He then joined up as a captain in Braddock's army and was in that action to take Fort Duquesne, or Pittsburgh for us. Hugh Mercer will be wounded in the arm, and in all the confusion got left behind. He did manage, though, to catch up with the lads that Washington had saved and kept on treating them. But while I'm on Hugh Mercer, our Jacobite now working for the English and soon to work for George Washington and his Americans, I should tell you about the next year, 1756, and his captain for Lieutenant Colonel John Armstrong, which will lead him to a particularly nasty battle. Hugh Mercer will cop a bad wound and again be separated from the troops. This time he's got to trek 100 miles through the wood. That's going to take him 14 days and he didn't have any supplies. He will get back to Fort Cumberland and be promoted to Major, and that's where he'll become a lifelong friend of George Washington. These guys will be in another attempt to take Fort Duquesne and this time succeed. A new fort will be erected called Fort Pitt, after William Pitt, and the place can become Pittsburgh. And so where we're up to in our podcast, we would have Princess Sophie of Anhalt-Zerbst being in her late 20s. She will shortly be taking over Russia and be known as Catherine the Great. So we've got season 3 of The Great out, and once again, it's not history. It's kind of dealing with the Pugachev Rebellion, but yeah, not history. Even so, it is just marvellous good fun. Just a great fun TV series. I really love it. The Great Season 3. We've also had Season 3 of Warrior, where we still have
the Irish migrants not liking the Chinese migrants coming here taking our jobs in San Francisco, and of course the Americans not liking the Irish migrants coming here taking our jobs either. But the thing is, like, you can vote for Party A or Party B and you'll find that both parties have a policy where they want migration. The reason our political leaders want migration inwards is that it keeps the price of labour down and also helps grow the economy for them. And then they can tell you, the nation is wealthier. Who gives a fuck? It's about us, not the nation. But there you go. Warriors Season 3 was also good fun. Lots of kung fu. And I see they've gone nicely woke. So we've got a gay couple in there as well. But there you go. But that's about it for this week. It's just a matter of what we go out with. And I think a bit of Don Henley. What about a bit of Don Henley? Okay, hope to see you next week. Bye.
Basket.